Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, we'll talk about the best organic gardening methods on How Homeopathy Helps to Grow Great Gardens, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck and international expert agrohomeopath Kavi Raj. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today, I will be speaking with a guest co-host, Mark Moody of Considerata.org, and he can help me to pronounce it correctly.
I would say Considera.
Considera. Okay, thank you. And Considera is fascinated with biodynamic agriculture, and you want to understand why and how, probably, to plant with nature, with the stars, how to use ashes to deter pests and weeds, how to use all different kinds of infinitesimal doses, which I imagine you're talking about homeopathy, to improve the land and to use the compost, and to improve the compost. And I'm sure that you can probably expound further upon that. And so I'd
Would you like me to do that now?
I do want to introduce you, you know, to our guests. You are a new co-host who has been gracious enough to give us a call and participate in our organic gardening show. Yes, why don't you just give a little bit of background, and then we're going to talk about the main theme for today, which is growing grapes for wine.
Okay, well, thanks, Debbie. Well, I'm sitting here in England where it's now 5 o'clock. So if you're, most of your folk are Americans, you're going to be probably around about midday. I call it infinitesimal doses because the potentizing process of homeopathy was my first introduction to such low doses or, you know, absent material. But biodynamics is a discipline that's been going since 1923, some lectures then in 1924, which also use inert, chemically inert materials in infinitesimal doses. And that's really what got me most excited, because here was a chance not only to heal the planet, but also to answer some of the questions about these doses on plants, which therefore I would assume are not subject to the placebo. So I just tried to put some science behind all of that, if not science, at least statistics, and that's what the Considera.org site is all about. Back to you, Debbie.
That's wonderful. We do need this type of information to verify to the skeptical public or those who are in a quandary about how it could possibly work, whether basically, they really just need to do the observations, and you're doing that with plants in a very scientific and organized fashion so that people can just look at the graph and see the changes that occur between those plants that are treated this way, organically, homeopathically, and see the difference in the production, in the growing process, and in the final harvest. So we're looking forward to learning a lot more about that and the kinds of results that you do get when you treat the plants in this fashion. Also, I would like to remind people that there is a daily newspaper, the Homeopaths Daily, on the internet, where Kavi Raj and many other homeopaths are posting information to their blogs about healing, health, the environment, stories in the news, all sorts of issues, and it's a good way that you can look at it all in one place. So today's story is the good news and the bad news about wine production. And I'm sure we're going to learn quite a bit more about a new bottling company, a vineyard that grows European wine from grapes using 100% homeopathic agriculture. That these tiny amounts of homeopathic products are used to treat fungi and insects. The first experiments were done in the Vinho Verde region, with the first harvest done in 2009 with a very limited number of bottles. So this is brand new. You're getting it hot off the press. And we're going to see in the years to come how this expands and maybe teaches other people who are planting vineyards these types of methods. In 2010, new experiments took place in the Alentejo region of Portugal. The grapes bore, and it's called Arcanus Alicante Boucher, were harvested in the September 2010, and so this is really recent. The wine is presently aging in oak barrels, and it will be launched exclusively onto the Portuguese and Brazilian market in July 2011. It sounds like you're going to have to go for a trip out of the country to get a taste of this particular brand of wine and see whether there's a difference in the final finished product. So this is a completely new approach to agricultural practice. And it is, as you say, with biodynamics, a greater way to practice organic gardening and give back to the earth and not take away or pollute the earth. So we're going to talk about also the way that over a good portion of time, vineyards have been planted and what the contemporary method of farming is using pesticides. I don't know, Mark, do you have any notes before you?
Hello, Debbie. Sorry, could you say that again? I just had to deal with a little family issue there.
Oh, that's okay. I was wondering if you have notes in front of you that I sent.
I have no notes.
Okay, so we're going to talk about what is a pesticide. Broadly defined, a pesticide is any agent that is used to kill or control any pest. And so pests can include not just what you think about pesticide being covering insects, but a pesticide includes eliminating and killing rodents or even birds, unwanted plants, weeds, fungi, or microorganisms such as bacteria and viruses. Though often misunderstood to refer only to insecticides, the term pesticide also applies to herbicides, fungicides, microbicides, rodenticides, and various other substances used to control pests. Under United States law, a pesticide is also any substance or mixture of substances intended for use as an insect or plant growth regulator, insect mating disruptor or egg sterilant, a defoliant or a desiccant. Many household products are pesticides, such as cockroach sprays and baits, rat poisoning, pet flea collars, products that kill mold and mildew, and kitchen disinfectants. So it covers a broad and wide range of chemical products that are in our environment and are used probably, I would say, indiscriminately and probably definitely an overuse in the environment and in our homes and gardens. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, I have come across this very broad definition, but mainly in legal arrangements. I think pesticide, if you were to take the word itself, the side, like in suicide and regicide, is to do with killing something.
Oh,
and
my.
Pesticide is, well, yeah, and pesticide means to kill a pest. Whereas when I've tried to take some of the potentized preparations to the regulators in the UK, they will use that much broader definition of just about anything that you can apply to plants which isn't fertilizer or water. And that blocks a lot of the commercial applications or the process to becoming a commercial product for these preparations. So as I understand it, and I'm very happy to learn something or be corrected, when one is giving a homeopathic remedy, one is stimulating the vital force so it is not susceptible to these pests and the diseases you've mentioned. Whereas if you've got something that actually kills the bug, you're not dealing with the underlying issue, you're just making sure that the manifestation of the problem cannot thrive. Regulators don't seem to have a sufficiently nuanced sense for the difference between killing a mouse and sweeping your floor so a mice doesn't come into your house. And this is a real problem for us in the regulation of all these products and therefore the ability to market them.
So you're saying it's very difficult for those in agro-homeopathy to get their product to market because they don't understand the principle and how it works, and they consider it to be a dangerous chemical, or what is it that they consider it?
There's a few more aspects to it than that. I don't think anyone thinks it's dangerous, but the regulator has set their net to catch the next DDT or the neonicotinoid or whatever it is that justifiably needs to be regulated because it's toxic. And it poisons the soil, poisons the air, poisons the water. However, that is the only regulation they have in Europe where I am. It's called the PPPR, which is Plant Protection Products Regulations. And so pesticides, in the meaning of the Act, has that broad brushstroke meaning. But I don't think they think that homeopathy can be toxic, but they have no other legislation with which to regulate it. So if we were to go to our local homeopathic pharmacy, we can get hold of this stuff, but it can't have any claims about its agricultural implications and use, because those label claims have to go through tests, and it's about £40,000, about $60,000-$70,000 for each preparation. And given that we've already tested maybe 100 or so preparations that you've seen from Kavaraj's book, and there's many others that. You know, you need to be married to a Rockefeller to even get on your way, really.
Okay, so this means that those people who are using it have to be self-taught, have to do research into homeopathy, have to, like, get Kaviraj's book and do some studying on their own and personal experimentation in their own garden, with their own crop fields, and see for themselves whether it works.
Sure, and that's a great thing anyway, but it means that you can't put the Helix toaster, you can't put it as a slug repellent on the shelf next to all the other slug repellents, because it has to be tested in order to be able to say that about itself without being illegal. Okay. And I think even if you talk to Kavaraj, is he coming along today?
We shall see. He didn't get a reply back. Okay.
He moves in mysterious ways.
Yes.
So I think in Western Australia he did very well with his slug repellent based on Helix toaster, but eventually the regulatory costs of meeting all this legislation was what meant he just had to back out. I said, and it's too expensive to play anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, but what it's doing is it's blocking the progress of this kind of application and full immersion into organic gardening and making your plants grow naturally and improving the plant itself from all of the onslaughts that could be out there in the environment. It's more living in harmony, and that is not something that they have a mentality to understand. It's all about this, as you say, the suicide, this killing machine. But because everything seems to be a war and a battle, whether it's against cancer or any kind of a disease, and that they apply that same mentality to plants. So go ahead.
To some extent, I would agree with you. I'm not so down on the regulators. I think that almost every one of those individuals, if you were to sit with them, would understand this it's not rocket science, but there's a huge inertia to any legislative process, which means that if you aren't perfect when you set it in stone in the year 2000, you're very unlikely to set it on a new course within the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. So if we're to make it a mainstream approach, which has, of course, the conceptual barriers and the lack of any the model for the mechanism of homeopathy, etc., etc., you know, there's all the barriers, but the regulatory one is going to be real slow to turn around unless there's fantastic amounts of money or we get some major breakthroughs. And in the meantime, we have to be a little bit more cunning and nuanced in how we tell the world about what we think it can do.
Right. Well, that's one of the reasons why we have the Vaccinations and Your Rights radio show each Thursday, which is at noon also, because we want not only to teach about healthy living and being a conscientious provider for your children and your family about what kinds of medications and things that you give them, but also what you can do as an active civilian in your region. You know, what can you do to change legislation? And I don't know how much is going on with the general population in terms of plant regulation. So that's a really important point that we need to learn about, how we can make changes for the rules and regulations that limit us, whether we're planting in our garden or we're taking a vaccination or we have certain kinds of herbs or homeopathics on our shelves in the pharmacy. And these are things that are really in the news today. So we're going to go a little bit more. You want to make a comment?
Well, no, I'll just say that it's bound to be different in the States than it is in in the UK here. I know Germany had a very is this interesting for you and your listeners to hear the variety of the legislative
sure.
issues?
Yes,
okay.
We
well,
have lots of it.
Okay. Well, in Germany, up until recently, and I think it's about to change this summer, they had a regulation which allowed various homeopathic and energetic, in inverted commas, applications to the land just to be registered for, you know, a very small fee and then to fly, because they realized that they were set in a sort of internal contradiction in that they were looking for toxic effects, but it was a law they couldn't police for homeopathy because there's no residues. But unfortunately, rather than the sensible legislation seeping into the stupid overwhelmed the sensible. So that's about to change there, so that all the products need to go through this very expensive testing, if I've understood correctly. Mm-hmm. In France, they had something similar where some of the ancient remedies that have always been used, kind of like peasant folklore, were tried to be banned by some of the big money companies. And there was such an outcry by the French people that a law came in saying all this old stuff was allowed to be kept, and many things like homeopathy looked like, and still do, it's still being discussed, it looked like that could slipstream that reactive legislation.
That would be great.
Be possible. Well, yeah, we're watching closely.
So to like grandfather it in.
Exactly, the grandfather rights. But
yeah.
I have to say it's the same in India and Pakistan and all over the world. Australia is very tough. New Zealand was okay for a little while and it's getting tougher. So it's a strange patchwork, but generally you have to play by the big boys' rules if you're going to go commercial.
Okay. we have a question from the chat. We have a live chat on the Blog Talk Radio. And Victor is asking if there is any differences in the final wine products, the taste, fragrance, natural sugar content, if homeopathy was used on the vines and the soil, or is homeopathy in wine production is primarily for conserving nature and protecting our health? That's just one of the questions coming in.
Would you like me to have a shot at that?
Yes. You probably have some experience with maybe, I don't know whether particularly wine or other kinds of fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. Primarily with vegetables, but wine, well, because I publish Kavaraj's book, and I maintain the Consider site, so whenever there's anyone who says I've had a definite experience, I put it there as a catalogue, not as proof, but just kind of
recording,
organizing the anecdotes.
Mm-hmm.
With wine, there was a very interesting story, but in order to be able to tell it, I would have to just take a minute to explain the biodynamic approach. Is that okay?
Excellent. We want to learn about the biodynamic approach.
Okay. So Rudolf Steiner was behind this. You may know of him from Steiner Schools. He was a polymath who died in the 1920s. He basically set up a polarity or pointed out a polarity between what happens in the springtime when the earth and the water really need to be in good nick to get a good big plant with large leaf areas photosynthesizing away with a good grip on the earth through a good rootstock. That's the kind of thing you want from your spring. The polarity to that is in the latter part of the year where the plant is less vigorous, but the fruit begins to come and the sugars grow and the dry matter forms and you get all these nice complex things. And I think for a wine grower, although this is totally not my area of expertise, so I apologize, I think the terroir, you know, the idiosyncrasies and the characteristic flavors are all to do with what happens in that latter period on the foundation that you've established in spring.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a plant that won't flower, then you try and emphasize that latter part of the year, wherever you happen to be in the season. Or if you've got a weak plant because it's been dry in the spring, too dry for things to grow, you'll use this, another of the polar preparations. So very often you will use what's called preparation 500, which is cow muck and a cow horn and stirred for an hour, to establish mm-hmm. the plant in spring and get it big and bushy. And then you would tend more towards the what's called 501, which is more silica put in the cow horn, stirred for an hour, if you want to get the flavors, etc. So that's the basic ABC of the practice. There's the theory and many other things to go with it, but that's the basic polarity with which it works. So a story that came through recently was came from a chappie called Glenn Atkinson, who has an organization called BD Max, and he was in Chile. He's an Australian living in New Zealand because that in the north of New Zealand, that's where a lot of the fruit is grown for the apples that we get here at the wrong time of year and the tamarillos and the kiwi fruit. But a lot of the kiwi fruit market has gone over to Italy and to Chile, particularly Chile for, I presume, the labor costs. So he was over there and talking to a Chilean guy who also had some vines, and he gave him the preparation 501 or his potentized version of 501 to put on his vines. But the guy misunderstood that it should be used maybe once or twice during the season. He put it on every week.
Mm-hmm.
So what he got was a crop that hadn't the polarity that stops the vigor that brings in the flavors was overemphasized, and it became an unbalanced plant. And I believe the vineyard looked like a storm had hit it. But it was the best wine they'd ever had. And from the sommelier's point of view, it tasted great. But it was mm-hmm. a low yield. So in answer to your gentleman's question, which I don't have in front of me, it would seem that one can bring in those qualities to the crop, and that is reflected in the quality of the wine. But in that case, it's an unbalanced application merely that serves to prove a point. So I hope that somewhat addresses the gentleman's question.
Right. Well, it would be interesting to see what will happen in that particular vineyard when, now that he's learned the proper application, whether mm-hmm. it will still produce a very tasty wine, but in a more balanced and even production, and maybe a bigger yield, so he can have a tasty, good tasting wine at the same time, and a lot of product in the end. So
yeah.
We don't know that until future applications.
Exactly, and hopefully he will then emphasize the other pole to bring it back into a balance, and then he's got a chance of doing exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's another question by Dr. Bob, but I'm not sure exactly what he is referring to. So we'll just move on. I wanted to talk a little bit more, kind of going back into the information about pesticides. And the reason that I wanted to talk about pesticides is because there is a story in the news about pesticides kill a French wine grower, which is very recent, January 29, 2011. A French wine grower who died after contracting leukemia was becoming the first farmer to have his illness officially linked to the pesticides he used for years on his crops, and had spoken from, they say, beyond the grave, giving a warning to the industry. Yannick Chenek was the first farmer in France whose death was officially linked to pesticides sprayed on his crops. He was 43 years old and had cultivated vineyards and other crops for decades at his farm in Ruffec in the Poitou-Charentes region of southwestern France. Pardon my French pronunciation. His death has served to highlight the dangers of working on the vineyards. He is among 40 or so farmers in France whose illnesses have now been officially linked to their profession and the pesticides they have sprayed on the land by the French Agricultural Public Health Body. Speaking shortly before his death, Mr. Chenet said, "When I got to the hospital, I saw the same company whose name was on the pill box as the one that made the farming products. I said, quote, it can't be true. The same group that poisoned me is now treating me," unquote. I think this is kind of a familiar sound statement that has been heard about those organizations, industrial chemical engineers and producers are also producing chemotherapy. And so they're in kind of the two ends of the spectrum, like those polarities you spoke about. They give the disease and then they treat it. So they make money on both ends. Paul Francois.
Must be quite an irony for that guy.
Well, I think he's no longer with us, but
yeah.
just to make that realization. And what I've learned is that there are 50 pesticides, and this is what I wanted to go into, that there are so many different pesticides that are being used for these crops. The active ingredients are the specific chemicals contained in the pesticide product that are designed to kill, like you said, a particular pest. By law, the active ingredient must be identified by name on the label together with its percentage by weight. And what is very interesting is the word inert. We think of something being inert. It can't harm you. It doesn't have any effect on anything else. But inert ingredients are commonly mixed with the active ingredients to create a formulated pesticide product. And these formulated pesticide products are the form of the pesticide that is available to the consumer, the grower, or the pest control applicator, and may take the form of sprays, which means that we could be inhaling it, bait stations, which means that what other animals are in its vicinity could be affected by it, fly strips, flea collars, dusts that also could be into the air. So these inert ingredients include solvents, emulsifiers, spreaders, and other substances mixed into pesticide products to increase their effectiveness of the active ingredient. It sounds very much like what we think of when we talk about adjuvants, but that is a different thing, and make the product easier to apply or to allow several active ingredients to mix into one solution. An inert ingredient is simply an ingredient in the product that is not intended to affect a target pest. Inert ingredients can be as much as 99% of the pesticide product. Both the U.S. EPA and the California Department of Pesticide Regulation require pesticide manufacturers to identify the inert ingredients in their products, but they do not disclose this information to the general public. because the pesticide industry considers product formulations trade secrets protected by the law. And to go a little bit further, many of the inert ingredients have adverse health effects and may themselves be used as pesticides. That is kind of a double switch to say that they're just these inert ingredients are being used just to improve the application and the spread and all that, and yet they themselves can be have adverse health effects. In fact, at least 382 chemicals on the U.S. EPA list of pesticide inert ingredients are or were once registered as pesticide active ingredients. This is truly amazing information for people who think when they read something is inert and they think, oh, that's okay, I can just spread it around everywhere. And to think that it is 99% of a product, and, you know, this is something that people are probably not very aware of. You want me to continue? I'll go on even further.
Well, I'm kind of interested to hear what your main point is about that, because I would do exactly the same. The devil's in the details with these things, because with homeopathy, there's a lot of alcohol in there. And as we know, that's responsible for most of the traffic accidents in the world. So if one has to be fair in making these criticisms so that, you know, we don't make ourselves ridiculous, we have to be able to understand exactly what they are on a case-by-case basis, because a lot of those inert materials are exactly what they say, and they help the pesticides stick to the plant, or, you know, that they keep them spread out within the mixture that's there. So on a case-by-case basis, if we have some information that shows they're dangerous, then by all means, let's get excited about it. But
when we make a homeopathic remedy and we use alcohol, we are not spreading that a large quantity of alcohol, because we dilute it in water to a great extent. Is that not correct, or am I misunderstanding?
No, you're absolutely right, but my only point is that until we have the details of each particular issue, and we know whether it's killing the bees or if it's killing the people who spray them.
Yes, then, and there is that information. I mean, we're talking we do have a loss of bee population, and there are many theories about why. That we can talk about that in a little bit. So let's learn a little bit more about the 8 inert ingredients are considered by the U.S. EPA to be of, quote, of toxicological concern, unquote, and another 75 are potentially toxic. The U.S. EPA strongly encourages registrants, those are the manufacturers and companies who buy and repackage pesticides for market, to substitute less toxic substances for these hazardous inerts in pesticide products. Nevertheless, a large but unknown quantity remain in use. So we really don't have all of the data in, but they're giving us a caution, a warning.
Yes.
While the identity of the specific inerts in a particular pesticide product is not available to the public, it is possible to estimate the quantity of inert ingredients released into the environment. And here's just from one state in the United States, California Pesticide Use Reporting, PUR, data. In 1998, a total of 215 million pounds of pesticide active ingredients and 134 million pounds of inert ingredients were implied in California alone. Pesticide products used in urban areas typically contain more inerts than in agricultural use pesticides. That's pretty interesting, too.
Interesting.
So we have a lot of facts, and we don't really know how all of these products affect human population. But there's a list on the pesticideinfo.org, so www.pesticideinfo.org website, that will list the top 50 pesticides used on wine grapes, with information on the identity, the use of type and toxicity of each pesticide, as well as gross pounds used, the application rate, the acres planted, and the number of applications. And I just want to give you a little heads up on a couple of the types of pesticide products. So they could be inorganic, petroleum derivative, halogenated organic, phosphonoglycine or glycine, polyalkyloxy compounds. And, you know, it's, to me, it's like reading a package of ingredients on your bread. And if you have something other than just flour and water and sesame seeds and yeast, and it goes into this huge long list of chemical ingredients, I put it back on the shelf. It's not something I'm going to pick up. So I can go on with inorganic copper, 2,6-dinitrianiline, diphenyl ether, organophosphorus, triazine, bipyridylium, aniline, dithiocarbonate, inorganic zinc, strobin, pyrimidine, somebody's pronounced that correctly, pyrimidine, alcohol ether, silicone, microbials, and fatty acids. So those are a few of how these pesticide chemicals are, what their base is. And we would have to really investigate what these things can do in the environment. Don't we know organophosphates, are they any good for the environment?
Well, they have a bad record in some of the diseases that affected the farmers over here who had sheep dip. And I think some of the CJD, the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, like symptoms have been heavily linked to the organophosphates. So yeah, they're particularly, they have a reputation, let's put it that way.
Right. So in our laundry detergents, they've tried to eliminate them because they know that they're not good. Yet they could be used as a part of a, I don't know if it's the inert ingredients of the pesticide, which can, it's not going to disappear. These products are going to be in there.
Yeah. I mean, that's maybe an instance of the care we need to take, because the phosphates in detergents are there to so-called soften the water, to make the surfactant activity last longer. Organophosphates are a slightly different and more chemically active, and seem to have neurotoxicological effects. So, in that small print, there's a lot of detail, a whole load of science and regulators all over who know the difference and who have some idea of which is going to do what. And so, in a way, I'm a little bit critical of the regulators in that they're using the same net for homeopathy as they are for these processes. I'm really glad that they are making sure that the worst of these, at least, are regulated. Then again, there is a lot of room for dodging and weaving in that inert column, and one suspects that some of the companies involved are, will get away with whatever they can get away with. And, that makes me nervous, and I'm glad there's things like the Pesticides Action Network and the people you just mentioned.
Right. It's important, I think, because California is a high production for vineyards, and that they are also very, they're on the West Coast, and they're, hippies. You think of them as really into health and really into caring for their families and thinking out of the box and that kind of thing. And so they are probably speaking up more. But what I'm getting information from Dr. Bob, I don't know whether he's called in today. He hasn't called in. He says that France uses more insecticides and fungicides on their wine grapes than any other country in the world, and that the France are not really regulating or inspecting for pesticide residues. The FDA regulates U.S. wines, and people have been poisoned, he said, by French wine. And that is why this particular story about Mr. Chenet, let's see, it says Paul Francois, who is age 47, a farmer, and Mr. Chenet's close friend, also suffers from severe health problems and was recognized as being linked to the products. In April 2004, he inadvertently breathed the noxious fumes from his agricultural spraying machine without a mask on. I guess you have to be really, really careful when you work with these types of products. Immediately, he was admitted to the hospital and fell into a coma. Since then, his illness continues to affect his kidneys and nervous system. He has again fallen into a coma. It was difficult to admit that this profession that Yannick started working at the age of 14 or 15 years old, and it was his passion, was what poisoned him. It is very painful, said his friend Paul Francois. And so I think that the French have been really up in arms about GMOs, and maybe they're going to be more active in regard to production of wine because it's one of their greatest exports. And to realize that for so many years, people have been involved with the production using these toxic chemicals and realizing the link that is officially being made now. So...
Well, I think what you're saying really outlines a responsibility we have, because there's no doubt that all these things do have warning signs, and you're supposed to wear the right gear and dilute it correctly, and you certainly, everyone is aware of the danger of these preparations, because if they can kill an insect, then in some dose or other, they're not going to be good for you. We know that.
Mm-hmm. And they build up.
Absolutely.
These things, they build up in our bodies over time. We're at the top of the food chain here.
Yeah, no, there's that hyperaccumulation that goes on. There's many, many things to worry about. I think it's right to alert that. But I think it's also good to be aware that, or to consider it from the grower's point of view, that
these are
all small businesses that haven't yet got... alternatives that they feel that they can trust. And
mm-hmm.
I think that it's a responsibility on those of us not just to criticize, but also to put something in place which says, look, try this because you can drink it by the gallon and you'll be fine, but it will mitigate your problems to the point where you can still be economically viable and maybe even thrive. So the Pesticide Action Network and the chaps you mentioned earlier, it's wonderful. That consciousness raising role is terrific. But rather than curse the darkness, I think we need to light the candles of agrohomeopathy. And that means doing the really good science as well as we can, collecting that work and you know, sponsoring a few people like Kavaraj or whoever to do really good tests and say, look, try this. We're confident now that we've got something which is non-toxic and it's effective in these specific instances. We've done our work, so we know it's Cabernet Sauvignon, but not a Riesling or whatever grape it has to be. And we know that it needs to go on at this stage before one of the mildews appears. You know, we need to hone our act to that scale so we can be responsible in this dynamic where, you know, we don't want any more of these guys getting poisoned. And God knows what's happening in the third world if in a place like France people are suffering.
Absolutely. So I really appreciate the scientific approach and the collecting of data and being able to provide exact instructions on how to apply homeopathics to a field. And I think that, you know, organic wine is becoming very popular. It's sought after. And the more that they learn that this is another part of the way that they can use their homeopathy in their production is going to be very good. So people in California will be taking notice. And the fact is we have got to get that word out. We have got to educate the public in some way so that they hear about it and come to us and ask more. Right?
Can I give an example of someone who's traveled that path?
Great.
Okay. Well, there's a gentleman in Lahore in Pakistan, and his name is Iftikhar Waris Shah. He's a homeopath with he's got two clinics. One is for addictions, and one is a more general homeopathic institution. And he noticed that because Pakistan is a heavily agricultural, rural community, reliant very much on cotton and on wheat. And he noticed in his clinic that the majority, or a significant amount, I can't say the majority, a significant number of people were coming with diseases that came from the chemicals that they were applying to cotton, which is a particularly hungry, or at least the way it's treated. It gets an awful lot of insecticides and pesticides. A lot of people were coming to him with the diseases that come from being around those chemicals. So in the 1990s, he thought, you know, I can treat some of this, or I can take the edge off some of this, but what I really need to do is see if we've got an alternative that can deal with the pest that address cotton. And in throughout the 90s and right up to 2009, he was going through this regulatory process, and he had his house on the market and all sorts of things in order to get the funds. But what he has done is got the Cotton Research Institute. It's called the Nuclear Institute of Agricultural Botany, which I always get confused with our. We got a similar NIAB over here, which is a different Institute of Agricultural Botany. But
say the name of it again. The nuclear what?
Institute. The Nuclear Institute of Agricultural Botany. Basically, all the big players in cotton, in research, and in the academic world, and they all tested his preparation. Now, Kavaraja is a little bit unhappy because it's not a single preparation. There's four different preparations, homeopathic remedies that have gone into that mixture that he used on cotton for mealybug, which is a pest that cotton gets. And he had it tested against the neonicotinoid. The neonicotinoids are a bunch of chemicals which I think they interrupt nervous pathways, but they seem to be heavily linked in the press at the moment with the problems besetting bees.
Okay.
He had it tested against a water control and the neonicotinoid, and in terms of the amount of nymphs and imagos of the mealybug, it was just as good as the neonicotinoid. But the guy spent 15 years working on that, and he went through all the expense of the process, but now he's got something that he's allowed to sell, which is completely homeopathic. I think it's so far over the Avogadro threshold, it's just not, there's nothing there. But he's taken it all the way through, played by their rules, and he's won. And
this
I think
is
he's a hero, I think he needs to be celebrated.
It's a success story, and I'll look for some more information. You'll give me some more information about that?
I can tell you where to look at it if you like.
Yeah.
If you go on to considera.org,
okay.
And then down to Preparations Plus Pioneers, you'll find all about it and some links to some articles and to the research that has come from the regulators, giving the percentages of how many mealybug were removed in relation to the control.
Okay, great. So that is
Considera, Siderara, that means the stars. So Considera is with the stars.
Uh-huh, okay.
.org.
I know you have a lot, you're going to teach us a lot about your website and what kinds of things we can find there. So,
just go and play. There's so much you can find there.
Okay. I'm trying to think. If I go back to the story about this particular gentleman, Mr. Chenet, in France, they said that there was no specific product that had been singled out by the French Agricultural Public Health Body, that they suspected benzene, a chemical frequently used as a solvent. Like when you're if you're a painter, you use benzene, or you don't really use it too much anymore because they've made latex products, but that's another whole story. By farmers, and they think that is what played a part in his contracting blood cancer. Other farmers have had Parkinson's disease and other cancers recognized as being linked to the products, and a victims association is being set up. So they are investigating, and I think it takes just like one person It's interesting. Just like you gave us the story about this one gentleman in Pakistan who took the positive road and did what he could and what he believed in, and his is ending up with a success story. Sometimes something happens to people, and for them, it is an alert signal, and the rest of the world will take notice. More than a quarter of the roughly 220,000 tons of pesticide used in Europe per year is sprayed onto French soil. Wow! Some 65,000 tons.
Did you give a percentage of how much goes to France?
Yes. It says more than one quarter.
Wow.
That's one quarter of the 220,000 tons of pesticides in Europe per year, that's annually, is sprayed onto French soil. That's 65,000 tons. So they're getting the big, the heavy of this. And a fifth of that amount, wow, goes onto French vineyards, despite the fact that these only account for 5% of the country's total crop surface. So you're talking about intensive amount of chemical product applied to a very small amount of the land. And I can't imagine what the runoff into the land, the water, the air would be for that.
Good question.
Yeah, there's an IUPP, the French group that represents 19 companies who market crop protection products in France, said that pesticides in the market are, quote, systematically the subject of test, and it is imperative to respect safety precautions on product labels. Let me see how much time we have left on the show. We have a little bit more time going. Xavier Boulin, head of France's main farmers union, which is called the FNSEA, said there was a lack of serious statistics on the subject, that only officially recognized molecules and active ingredients were on the market, and that it was setting up an awareness campaign on potential risks. Okay, so they are, you know, they've got a heads up on this. One person has made a difference, and other people are behind him. And you mentioned New Zealand.
Yep.
And New Zealand's organic biodynamic farming is another story that was posted on January 16th, 2011. 20% of vineyards in New Zealand will be farmed organically or biodynamically by the year 2020, according to a new target set by Organic Wine Growers New Zealand, OWNZ. So they're ahead of the game, and we should be putting our eyes toward New Zealand and watch what they do and see what the results are. The area of the country's vineyards under organic certification has tripled over the past 3 years, but so far only 1,500 hectares of vines in 150 vineyards are managed organically. That's 4.5% of New Zealand's total. It's a small percent, but they're saying by 2020, if they achieve 20% of the vineyards in the country as certified organic and biodynamic, it will be a giant step towards enforcing the precious environmental image to wine connoisseurs all over the world, says James Milton, organic grower and winemaker and chairman of the OWNZ. So this is good news, really.
It sounds like the kind of optimistic target you have to send yourself, but we wish him luck, and let's hope he's actually underestimated it.
That would be good if more people get on the bandwagon and realize and join the organic trend, which is going on now.
Mm-hmm.
There are 140. Go ahead.
Sorry, Debbie. In France, there's a company there who are taking some of the homeopathic products to work with them on the vineyards. They're a young company, but they primarily deal with calcified seaweed. But they're doing some trials this year, and I've organized, in fact, I'm going up to get the preparation from Mr. Iftikhar Waris's grandson on Saturday. That will then go over to France, and they'll be doing some tests because they do have a particular problem with the vines at the moment that the chemicals are no longer touching. So that they're looking into these things. There are people working on it. So there's hope, even with the French.
Right. So you're saying that the problem, whatever that might be, I don't know whether you said whether it was a bug, a fungi, or whatever it is actually no longer, if these products are no longer effective, just like antibiotics are creating superbugs. So in the same way, when we apply these massive amounts of chemicals, and you can hear the number in France, that the survival mechanism of the organisms is going to supersede what we can do in terms of chemicals.
Yep, that's a familiar pattern, isn't it?
Yes, it's everywhere. And as a matter of fact, if anybody wants to see, Dr. Andrew Wakefield has just done an interview with Mike Adams on Natural News, and he says similar things about nature will take its course. It has a inner vital force to survive, and it will do that no matter what we apply. So we need to learn how to live in harmony with these what we're calling pests, but bacteria, virus, fungi, they have evolved along with us through the millennia, and somehow we're recognizing them as attacking us, and we need to understand that they can be very helpful in many ways. If
Absolutely.
We just keep the ecological system intact and the cycles of life intact and not disrupt them in any way like we're doing with these GMO sterile seeds or the fertility disruptors.
It's a fundamentally different step to see the pest as a scavenger that cleans up your mistakes, or a pest mm-hmm. that comes in just to piss you off, you know. And so if you've got a different approach, then you have to welcome them. It's just like saying, I've got a pain in my leg, so I'm going to take a painkiller, or I got a pain in the leg, so therefore I'm going to take it out of that lion's mouth. You know, there's a real difference in attitude. And
yeah.
with a bit of luck, we will be able to build up that health in the plants over time sufficiently that the pests will be not a major problem. They will currently just the indicator that we've got something wrong, and hopefully soon they will get into a nice laid back pattern where they're saying, okay, you're doing good enough, we're not going to be a problem, but we're waiting until you mess up again, and then we'll be grateful for our pests.
Yes, gratitude is very healing. So we are at the end of our hour. I want to thank everyone who has listened. You can download these shows at any time and listen and share them. And we're going to continue to talk about organic growing Wednesday at noon. Thank you so much, Mark, and I hope people will visit your website and learn more about what you do. So
thanks very
we're
much,
going
Debbie.
To close the show in, I, again, thanks to all our listeners, and you can share our show with friends. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens with co-hosts Kaviraj Vaikuthanath and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to get some sunshine and light up your life in your garden.